A COVID whistleblower, misinformation coming from Miami Spanish media, and the Bitcoin frenzy hits South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Rebecca Jones lost her job at the Florida Department of Health when she argued that the state wasn't being truthful with its daily COVID statistics. She's now able to call herself a whistleblower. So what happens next? Also, a new report on Miami Spanish radio station shows that there's a lot of misinformation being spread without being checked. And finally,
most people at this conference believe Bitcoin is monetary freedom for the world.
Miami was host to a massive Bitcoin event. Has everyone bought into the idea of cryptocurrency? All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, back in December, police raided the house of Florida's former COVID data expert, Rebecca Jones. They took computers and phones. For months, she had been the target of Governor DeSantis as he tried to get the state reopened quickly. Recently, the Inspector General for the Department of Health announced that Jones was given the designation of whistleblower. Joining us now is Miami Herald reporter Sarah Blasky. Sarah, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I wanted to go back to that night in late last year. Law enforcement goes in, gets computers, gets the phone. Again, Rebecca Jones, the former data expert for the state during the pandemic, leaves under very interesting circumstances. What did the state get out of those computers and phones? Do we know what the information was that she was holding on to?
So thanks so much for having me. The story of Rebecca Jones has gotten very confusing over the last year. And so to clarify the timeline a little bit, Rebecca Jones was fired from her position at the Florida Department of Health last May. So 1 year ago now, just a little bit over 1 year ago. And then about 6 months later, at the beginning of December, police raided her home and took her computers and cell phone in the morning. One morning, and they were looking for evidence that she sent a message to a secure chat in November that's usually used by emergency personnel in Florida to give out emergency messages. And allegedly, Rebecca Jones was suspected to have sent a message asking everyone else to take a stand before more people die, a sort of cryptic, call to action, if you will. She has been charged with a third degree felony of illegal access to a secure platform. However, she denies that she did it, and that case is still pending. So that is a separate criminal case than what has happened in her whistleblower case. And her whistleblower case has everything to do with what happened at the Department of Health last May.
And, you know, just to mention, too, that, you know, she was basically keeping the data for the pandemic, all the figures for the state, and then leaves. And then she starts her own site and is tracking the data, her own data on the pandemic, coinciding with whatever or parallel to what the state was doing. So she claims to be a whistleblower and she wanted that declaration. But real briefly, what happens if you are called a whistleblower? What kind of protections do you have? What was she looking for?
So whistleblower complaint in what Rebecca Jones did is filed with the Florida Commission on Human Relations. And it's a complaint that you were fired for inappropriate reasons. And then when it becomes a whistleblower complaint, when you reach that designation, what that means is that your claims within your complaint meet that designation that's protected by Florida law that says, you know, if you see something, basically say something. If you suspect something is going wrong while you're working, say something. Interestingly, you don't actually have to be correct about what you're saying. If anyone retaliates against you for raising an issue with your bosses, or a suspected issue with your bosses, that would be a violation of Florida law. And so what has happened is Rebecca Jones' case has been reviewed. Some members of the Department of Health have been asked for comment in affidavits that are filed in this case with the Florida Commission on Human Relations. And then also separately, the Office of the Inspector General has also announced that there is reasonable cause, and that's their phrase, reasonable cause to to suspect that there may have been some wrongdoing by a boss or someone named in Rebecca Jones' case. Now, that wrongdoing, to be clear, could just be retaliation. It doesn't have to mean that there's any data manipulation. It could just be the act of retaliation. We don't know what that specifically would be.
Yeah.
But I think, I think it's important to go back to the beginning and really look at what happened. And that's what the Miami Herald tried to do in our recent piece, is what actually led to this. Because ultimately, Rebecca Jones was the person in charge of presenting data publicly. She wasn't actually the keeper of the data. And the data that she used on her new COVID action is actually the same data that the Department of Health was publishing. And so it really comes down to the way data was presented and the way that it was used by the government. And that was really the core of her whistleblower complaint that the Miami Herald has obtained and reviewed, as well as the other responses from the Florida Department of Health. It has everything to do with the public presentation of the data.
And so now she gets that designation. How does that change her trial?
So it doesn't change anything that I am aware of about the criminal case against her, because that is a separate thing. She is accused of doing something separately that will play out separately. The whistleblower case will mean that she, if they do find that she was inappropriately fired, she could receive some sort of compensation for that. It means that this investigation will go into the next phase. She's basically moved through the initial phases. Her case has been given enough merit that the investigation will continue. And potentially the end of that would be that she will could see some sort of payment for damages or that kind of thing, if indeed it is found that she was retaliated against for the concerns that she raised last May.
And that was, again, that was announced last week. In your story, something interesting is that right before the raid, that Jones reached out to Jared Moskowitz, the former director of emergency management for the state. Why?
So actually, Jared Moskowitz reached out to Rebecca Jones about a month and a half after she was fired from the Department of Health. And they have this almost year-long to date series of DMs on Twitter and Signal messages back and forth where, you know, she's kind of looking for information from former director Moskowitz about what's going on inside the Department of Health. She keeps this blog. She wants to inform her Twitter followers. And you can see the former director engaging with her on that. They sometimes vent to each other about the Department of Health, but former director Moskowitz also said that the reason that he engaged with Rebecca Jones is because he was worried she was going to spread disinformation on the internet, that he was worried her tweets in particular were inaccurate, and he wanted to try to work with her to make sure that the information that got to her 400,000 followers was indeed accurate. And so that's kind of where he comes down to it. And then on the day after the day of the raid, a couple hours after Rebecca Jones goes and buys a new cell phone after hers is confiscated, the first person she texts, other than her friends and family and lawyer, is former director Moskowitz. And she warns him, electronics have been confiscated. There might be, your boss, the governor, might find out that we've been communicating. And
is that a reason why, part of the reason why he left his position?
He says no. He maintains that all of the reasons that he gave publicly are the correct reasons. So he wanted to spend time with his family. His child asked him to come home, basically. And he maintains that his interactions with Rebecca Jones had nothing to do with him having any real concerns about what was going on in the state government, but more with making sure that, no disinformation was spread. Now, I will say this is an ongoing conversation. There are lots of examples where they talk quite casually about what is going on. And so I'll leave it to the listeners to decide. But that is what we're told from both sides. And certainly Rebecca Jones has considered the former director a confidant throughout the last year.
We're talking with the Miami Herald reporter, Sarah Blasky. We're looking into the recent report from the Florida Department of Health and its handling of former data specialist Rebecca Jones. Jones recently, again, winning her request to be called a whistleblower. and what that means for her moving forward. You could follow Blasky's reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jones, you know, Sarah, Jones has been a controversial figure. Like, even went back when she was working with the state, you know, her past, she's been arrested in the past, though not charged on anything. She's gotten into Twitter fights with people, and then she's erased some of her tweets. She's been a controversial figure on both sides. What was it like, though, you know, for you as a reporter? How'd you approach reporting on her? How do you question her credibility?
So I think the most important thing for the Miami Herald here was to make sure that everything that we had was in documents and not just in her complaint, but in the responses from the state. I think that's what really helped us be able to report on this in a way that, you know, cuts through all of the controversy of whether or not she is credible, because of course much of the article that we reported is actually based on the sworn statements of her bosses at DOH and what they said about what was going on at the time. And to give a sort of brief summary, aside from all of the claims or the, you know, tweets that have been taken down and all of the things that have happened after she left the Department of Health, what was confirmed in these documents are two things: that Rebecca Jones was asked to remove data from the public portal. Remember that her entire complaint is about a falsifying, so misleading the public with public data on the DOH website. That's what the top of her complaint says. That is why she's filing this complaint, is that she was fired for her refusal to falsify data on a public website. And what the DOH officials say in their sworn statements is she was asked to remove data from the public website after difficult questions from the Miami Herald last May. That did happen, according to her bosses. Now, there's some disagreement about, you know, why it was inappropriate and all of that, but that did happen. And then the other biggest thing that is confirmed, not by Rebecca Jones, but by her bosses, is that despite the fact that Governor Ron DeSantis's reopening plan says that it was made with public health data at the forefront, the Department of Health did not give any recommendations on reopening at all. Those are the words of Dr. Shamariel Roberson, who the Deputy Secretary of Health at the Florida Department of Health, and that's in her sworn statement. And so bringing it back to your original question, I think that the way that we tried to approach this was not to do a tit for tat on the noise around what's happened afterward, but to really drill down into, you know, what happened at the Department of Health. What was the context here? And how do we know that beyond just what Rebecca Jones says? Because as you point out, you know, she shoots from the hip on Twitter. She doesn't always give context. Some people say she's wrong. All of those things, you know, could be true, but the core of the reporting focuses on everything before that.
And to mention this out just today, Rebecca Jones' account has been suspended from Twitter. That's been her main form of communication to hundreds of thousands of her followers. No clear reason yet why it was suspended. The line says, quote, Twitter suspends accounts that violate the site's guidelines. So we're looking into that to see, you know, if there's anything else to that. But I wanted to get to the Department of Health here in a moment, because they announced something last week. But where are we at right now? Where is Rebecca Jones right now? And where are we on this trial?
Right. So just to answer your question about the Twitter account suspension, I've actually received the email that Twitter sent to Rebecca Jones. And the reason that she was suspended is for spam, for violating the spam policy of Twitter. And so, you know, I think she may have been posting over and over and over again various articles on Twitter, but it is not for the reasons that at least a lot of my sources instantly texted me about. It was not apparently for any sort of false content or anything like that. It is for a spam violation.
All right. Well, thank you for the clarification on that. Yeah.
So where we're at, you know, in terms of the criminal case, it is still pending. There is no set date to my knowledge. It's unclear how that moves forward. In terms of the whistleblower complaint, that is, to my understanding, in legal review. So after it makes it through legal review, that part that's in the Florida Commission on Human Relations should become a public document, and then everyone can have access to it. The OIG investigation will be ongoing, and we'll be waiting to see what they turn up as they look into whether or not there was any, you know, specific wrongdoing on the part of any of Rebecca Jones' bosses last year when she was fired. Yeah.
And the other thing, too, was just the report came out, the Department of Health no longer releasing daily updates on the pandemic. Do we know or have any idea how that's going to impact Jones's work and those attempting to monitor the spread of the virus?
Yes. So the weekly updates, it was expected and honestly is totally understandable. From what I understand from my sources at the Department of Health, you know, you're talking about a bare bones team that has been under a lot of pressure for a year, and putting out those daily reports has been a ton of work for them. And as the pandemic is starting to slow down a little bit, it makes sense to a lot of people involved that they would go weekly. The thing that's going to impact Jones and frankly other researchers that have been pulling data from the data hub, the back end of that dashboard, is that they're no longer publishing that or updating that at all. And what that means is all of the dashboards, like what Jones created, what Dr. Jason Salemi has created, all of those will need to be transferred to other data sources. So they might be able to continue reporting, but they'll be dependent on CDC data, which the CDC will tell you is not as up to date as anything coming directly from a State Department of Health. And so it's really unclear how Jones and anyone else, and there are lots of researchers that were pulling from that data. The Miami Herald pulls from that data, right?
Yes.
So it remains to be seen how getting rid of the caseline data and that will impact research and dashboards across the state.
She is Sarah Blasky from the Miami Herald. Check out her reporting on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. There is a lot going on in this one. Sarah, thank you so much. Always appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, misinformation about the Capitol insurrection is coming from all different places, including some Spanish radio stations in Miami. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Disinformation is rampant in our media landscape. A new report focuses on four Spanish language radio shows in Miami and the conversations they aired after the Capitol insurrection in January. What it found is alarming. Even more concerning, some of the baseless claims were endorsed by high-ranking politicians. Joining us now is WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett and Andrea Mercado. She is the co-executive director of Florida Rising, one of the organizations who created that report. I appreciate both of you. Andrea, I want to start with you. I mean, look, you grew up in Miami. What's been your experience here in South Florida when you think about, you know, what you hear in Spanish and English news media?
Thanks for having me. You know, I think the right-wing narratives it surrounds sound, and the problem's only gotten worse. I think we've seen in, 2020, the kind of machismo, conservatism, and outright lies that are being spread, especially on Spanish language radio outlets, is really disturbing and corrupting our public discourse.
Do you think, though, over time that you've seen one or both get worse?
Well, I think that there's this, I think we've seen both. I think we've seen our public discourse, you know, really deteriorating over the last 4 years with the spread of misinformation and disinformation. But on Spanish language radio, I think it's really egregious what they're able to get away with. And I think it's one of the reasons why we thought it was so important to do this case study monitoring what was being said in early January while the insurrection was taking place, to just show the extent of the problem.
Tim, would you say this, the spread of the misinformation in Spanish language media, is that predominantly just the talk radio, or is that on a lot of different platforms?
Oh, it's on different platforms. As Andrea pointed out, it seems most egregious on the radio airwaves, but print media in Spanish language in Miami is also very guilty of this. Newspapers like Libre, you'll remember, which was a focus of a big controversy last year during the election campaign, when it was airing or when it was printing just some very alarming, if not disgusting, racist and other sort of articles in it. That it's a Libre was a newspaper produced out of Little Havana. So no, it's not just radio, TV to a lesser extent, but because it's more visible, I think it doesn't feel like it can get away with as much as newspapers and radio stations here do. But no, it's not confined to radio.
And when you talk about those talk shows, and Andre, I want to hear your thoughts on this too. Do you have like a comparison in you know, English speaking programming anywhere in the country that you could say it's kind of like that? Tim, is there anything that jumps out at you?
Well, no, and let's be clear, English language radio is no stranger to this kind of disinformation either. I mean, you know, the Rush Limbaugh shows, the right wing radio shows that we hear all the time, even some left wing shows, unfortunately, as well. So no, English language radio is not immune to this at all. But the situation you have in Miami, though, is that because, look, Miami-Dade County is majority Latino. Spanish language radio is predominant radio here. Actualidad, one of the stations, for example, is the most listened to AM station in Miami. So the reach of Spanish language radio here is much further than you would see in other markets around the United States. And therefore, its disinformation that it broadcasts goes much deeper and has a more profound effect.
Yeah. Andrea, why did you decide to focus on talk radio for this report?
Well, I think because we've known that it's been a problem for so long. And I to Tim's point, you know, it's almost like the right has a monopoly on broadcasting their point of view. And I think it's really important that we call on Spanish language outlets to integrate newer Latino voices into their program that truly represent the diversity and the political diversity of our communities, and especially open up space for Afro-Latino voices. I mean, one of the things that we saw and what we were hearing in early January is, you know, first they tried to minimize the insurrection and try to pretend like nothing was really happening. And then it was an all out attack on the movement for Black Lives, saying that it was Black Lives Matter that was responsible for inciting the insurrection. You know, things that we know that are patently false, but, you know, just really furthering and deepening racial divides and continuing to insist that, you know, Donald Trump won this election in ways that really undermine our democracy.
And you know, part of the report, too, you looked at a week's worth of pre-recorded radio programming surrounding that January 6th insurrection of the Capitol. Why do you want to focus on that?
It just felt like a moment in time, like all of us that worked on in 2020 on this election, we saw the disinformation that was happening on WhatsApp, on social media, on the radio. And as we were discussing the extent of the problem, you know, all of a sudden we have this attack on our nation's capital. And we were hearing reports of some of the things that they were saying. And it just felt like such an important moment to go back and literally listen to dozens of hours of Spanish language radio and capture some of the things that they were saying and documented and the ways that you had Representative Diaz-Balart and Representative Salazar legitimizing right-wing conspiracy theories on air.
Tim, this isn't new, or are we just now paying attention to it?
I think we're paying more attention to it now because we're seeing the broader political effect it's having, not just political effect, but as Andrea pointed out, the corrosive effect that it's having on our public discourse here in South Florida. But it's not new. This has been going on at least since I started covering Miami more than 20 years ago. It really shook me to be listening to this sort of thing during the Elian Gonzalez episode 21 years or so ago. Just the brazen disregard for facts and some of the very mean-spirited things that were being aired, for example, about the Attorney General at the time, Janet Reno, and her Parkinson's, the late Janet Reno and her Parkinson's disease. I mean, the stuff that was just coming out on Spanish language airwaves that I just couldn't help thinking would not be tolerated on English language airwaves.
Andrea, since the report was released, have you heard from any of these radio show programs, hosts, any public officials?
Some public officials that expressed their concern about what was documented in the report, not from the outlets themselves, although we're reaching out to them this week for follow-up and for conversations. You know, like I said earlier, we're not trying to silence our discourse, but we are calling on outlets to hold journalistic integrity and make sure that they're representing multiple viewpoints. I mean, there was a Miami was the focus of a lot of political analysis after the elections last year. And those of us who live here in South Florida, we know that South Florida is home to a very large right-wing and conservative Hispanic community. But there's also other points of view and other political perspectives. And it's on us to not only call out on the kinds of lies and racism and some of the really egregious things that are happening on Spanish language radio, but also to build the infrastructure that we need to present other points of view. You know, we're starting a Promotoras de la Verdad or a Truth Warriors program at Florida Rising.
But how do you share what we think
is necessary to expand democracy and to advance racial equity in our country,
you know,
in Spanish.
The challenge, though, is this, though, is how do you reach their listeners directly? Because if not, then everybody's just living in their own little media silo. And so they're only hearing what they want to hear. So how do you reach them to challenge those viewpoints and let them hear other voices? Yeah.
Well, that's the hard part, Lewis, BB, because, for example, I mean, one of the more moderate radio stations here, Radio Caracol, was just sold to a more conservative Spanish language media outlet. And the owners of that Caracol station told me that one of the reasons they were selling was because they were losing money. He was essentially telling me, if you're not right wing radio in the Spanish language market here in Miami, you're not going to make a profit.
So you have to go that route or else you're not in business. I mean, Andrea, you can please respond to that. Tell me what, you know, again, how do we reach that audience? What do you do?
I mean, I absolutely think that we have to invest in our own infrastructure and create more Spanish language progressive infrastructure to contest for people's hearts and minds and to share different points of view and uplift different voices. And we need to hold, you know, elected officials accountable. And, you know, some of these outlets make sure that we're calling them out on when the discourse is totally inappropriate and not worthy of our democracy.
I'm speaking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett and Andrea Mercado. She is the co-executive director of Florida Rising, a nonprofit working to increase civic engagement of minority groups. And that organization helped produce a report recently documenting the disinformation from Spanish talk radio programs in Miami. Tim, by the way, will have more on this story as part of his Latin America report, which you can hear during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And find more information on that report on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Tim, the report explores the contempt and spread of falsehoods about, as actually Andrea pointed out earlier, Black Lives Matter movement, linking the movement to socialism, even witchcraft. How have public officials participated? You know, you mentioned a couple of names, but what are they doing? Are they just going on air and saying yes to all this? Are they adding to the lies by telling more? What are they doing?
Well, Miami congresspeople such as Maria Elvira Salazar, who was elected last year, one of the reasons she was able to unseat the Democrat incumbent, I think, was she did sort of participate, as you say, in this disinformation wave that was going on Spanish language radio. For example, claiming that Black Lives Matter was a, quote, socialist, if not Marxist, radical Marxist group, she would often say on Spanish language talk radio, simply because, for example, there had been a picture that she had seen of one of the original Black Lives Matters members from many years ago taking her picture with Venezuelan socialist president Nicolas Maduro in New York, and therefore conflating that picture with the entire Black Lives movement to call it Marxist and also associate Black Lives Matter then with the Democratic Party and Joe Biden. It was all part of a, you know, a chain, but she was very much a part of that process, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you know, look, we have a clip here from one of these Spanish language radio talk programs. I believe this is Cada Tarde, a show from Actualidad Radio. This is the day after the Capitol riot. We'll take a listen to a little bit of it.
Un activista afroamericano del grupo Black Lives Matter. En varias ocasiones se sabe ya que ha pedido, según la cadena Fox, han pedido.
And so, Tim, more to what you were saying, what are they claiming about, you know, that attack? And, you know, again, where are they getting their information?
Well, in that particular clip, the co-host Karines Moncada and her co-host Agustina Costa of that show Cada Tarde on Actualidad Radio, they were claiming that facial recognition technology had proven that it was Black Lives Matter and Antifa activists who had infiltrated the Capitol insurrection mob, and they were the ones stoking the violence. And that was, of course, proven utterly false on every media platform, but they ran with that quite effusively, and it became part of the Spanish language radio narrative here.
All right, you know, Andre, I come back to you on this. So Tim tells me, you know, this is what you hear, and they're going to make claims, and they're going to claim that it's coming from this source and these reports and this. So how do you get around that? How do you help people who have been listening to that day in and day out, been indoctrinated into that idea? How do you get them to open their minds and say, okay, hold on a second, maybe they're, you know, because if I come and say to them, all of this has been disproven, they're going to call me a liar and say, nope, I have the report, it's been said.
So, I mean, that's organizing, really, and, you know, the work that we're doing in different parts of the state is equipping many community members with content, with alternative content, with alternative points of view, with, you know, some of the news and information that people maybe haven't been exposed to, so that people can open up a line of critical questioning. And we haven't really talked about it on this program, but, you know, WhatsApp was another vehicle for spreading disinformation. What does it look like for us to take that back and use it to spread content about, you know, what really happened, and, you know, what it is that we want for our families and our communities and to advance our state and our country.
Andre,
sharing that content for people to spread on their own social media through WhatsApp or Facebook. But I do think that the Spanish language radio is a real barrier for us to take on. And to, you know, I think there's some hopefulness that national outlets like Univision and Telemundo can create programs that have points of view, have some differing points of view, so that people can listen to different points of view and come to their own conclusions on what really happened. But that's really challenging to do when there's no factual,
Andrea,
basis.
Is there a way to hold those stations or any of those shows accountable?
I think there's different avenues. Obviously, there's advertisers who advertise on those programs. We've seen multiple campaigns on, and this is a tactic that's been used a lot on right-wing, when right-wing radio show hosts really spew very misogynistic or racist commentary. Sometimes going after the advertisers has been an effective strategy. There's, you know, meeting with the national executives or the top executives. I think there's different pathways that are being deliberated and are being discussed right now.
And Tim, to finish up, do the other Spanish speaking media outlets, are they trying to counter what's being said on some of these shows?
You do have some. One of the radio hosts on Radio Caracol, for example, former Hialeah mayor Raul Martinez, had a more moderate, more progressive toned talk show, very popular in the afternoon. But as soon as Caracol was purchased by this more conservative Spanish language media outlet, he was let go. He has his own show on YouTube now, but it obviously won't have the same reach that he had on Radio Caracol. So it's difficult.
That there's nobody, like, even in television, Spanish television, who's basically calling them out and saying, hold on, there's a lot of misinformation here.
Well, that would be ideal to see that. One of the problems, and I know Andrea mentioned this in a report, is that Radio Mambí, for example, one of the other radio stations here that is also responsible for a lot of this disinformation, is owned by Univision, the Spanish language TV network.
So much more to this report. And by the way, if you'd like to see more about it, we have it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I want to thank our Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett, and Andrea Mercado, the co-executive director of Florida Rising, the nonprofit working to increase civic engagement of minority groups. Thank you both so much. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Louis.
And by the way, you can share your thoughts on segments like this one. Just join our Sundial text club. Just type the word hello to 786-677-0767. That's 786-677-0767. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this. Well, still to come, some of the biggest names in Bitcoin were in Miami this weekend. Does that mean that South Florida is buying into crypto? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, tens of thousands of cryptocurrency enthusiasts were in Miami this past weekend for the largest Bitcoin conference in history. The conference included high-profile speakers like Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, former Congressman and Libertarian Ron Paul, celebrity skateboarder Tony Hawk was there. The event was sold out, and it included visitors and vendors from everywhere, all over the world. Digital artists, video game creators, even a NASCAR team was there. The conference was the first large-scale event in Miami since the start of the pandemic. Sundial senior producer Chris Remington was there, and he joins us now. I know he was having a good time. Chris, how did we get this? How did the big Bitcoin event come to Miami?
Hey, Louis. Thanks for having me. So actually, the event was supposed to be in Los Angeles this year, but the state of California is still in a state of emergency for the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, that limits the size of gatherings, and Florida has long lifted its state of emergency. So we welcome the conference. Miami Mayor Francis Suarez has been a huge proponent of turning Miami into a tech hub. The cryptocurrency exchange blockchain.com just came down here. And of course, former American Airlines Arena, now the FTX Arena, also a cryptocurrency exchange. A lot of buzz for crypto in Miami, and folks were excited to have the conference here.
All right. I hate to say it. I'm still one of those people who I kind of get it, but I don't completely get it. So
it's complicated.
All right. Briefly describe Bitcoin to the rest of us.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very complicated phenomenon. Just to sort of break it down in simple terms, Bitcoin essentially is a decentralized digital currency. Its ledger is peer-to-peer and anonymized on blockchain, which prevents the possibility of double spending. Okay, let's present this in simpler terms. It's an online currency. It doesn't require a central bank. In the US, we have a Federal Reserve that prints new coins and paper for us. Bitcoin doesn't have that. It has people all over the world that mine for the currency. They basically do complicated math equations, algorithms to find new coins. And it's not like they can keep printing Bitcoin forever. There's only 21 million coins in total. So folks just keep mining to find new coins, and that's how you get them.
By the way, do we know what the value of a Bitcoin is right now? Because I heard it's really high.
I mean, it has been shifting. The volatility has been crazy. I think last I checked, it was close to $40,000 for one Bitcoin, which is a huge jump from where it was last year. But it was all the way up to $60,000. So we know that the volatility of it, very high.
Now, you talked about Mayor Francis Suarez. He opened the event, and he's been a very big advocate for transforming Miami into this tech hub. But this, let's listen to part of his opening speech, by the way.
The transformational importance for my city of leaning into Bitcoin to make Miami a technological leader in the world.
All right. So, Chris, what else was Suarez's message there to folks who were inside this event?
Yeah, it's interesting, Lewis. I got there around 8:15 in the morning. Suarez was supposed to start at 9. And once I got inside, the place was still half empty. And it turns out, hearing from folks looking on social media and from what I saw outside, thousands of people were unable to get into the event for 3 to 4 hours. There was a huge line to check in. On social media, people were comparing it to the Fyre Festival in terms of how much they had to spend, and they still couldn't get inside. But needless to say, for the folks that were able to get in, it was very exciting. And Suarez's main message was that Miami is emerging as this new tech hub. He talked about his proposal to the city commission to allow City of Miami taxes to be paid in Bitcoin. Of course, the commission ultimately rejected that proposal, but Suarez is very excited for the future of it here.
All right. So the conference was hosted at the Mana Wynwood Convention Center. That's owned by billionaire real estate developer Moishe Mana. What did Mana say about getting this ready during it? We're still in a pandemic.
So Moishe was frank. He was optimistic about the trends in terms of the number of people who've been vaccinated against COVID-19. There was no proof of vaccination required, or wearing masks wasn't necessary. I wore my mask the entire time, but I was one of the few people that was. The event was a mix of indoors and outdoors, but again, all the main speakers were indoors inside the convention center. Mana said, look, if people have gotten vaccinated, I'm going to trust them and they'll be safe here.
And you talked to him also more about that optimism. Here's a little bit of that conversation.
You see, it's not a bang, wham, thank you, ma'am. You know, it's a process. We've been building in Wynwood day by day, event by event. And it's progress, it's evolution. It's not, we did one event, everybody gonna come, you know. So we've been working on it for 12 years, what you see here.
All right, so he's optimistic about the event, but how did he feel about Bitcoin and the future of Bitcoin in Miami?
Yeah, Moishe was very excited about it. He acknowledged that he doesn't know a ton of people that are using Bitcoin now for day-to-day purchases, but he sees great opportunities for it in the future. And he actually teased this possibility that his real estate company might be using Bitcoin at some point to invest in buildings and commercial real estate. But how that's going to take shape, still unknown. He's excited about it, but recognizes there's still challenges ahead.
See, I mentioned the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, was there. Controversial moment, but the focus of his speech was about banking the unbanked. All right, please help me understand. What is he talking about there?
Sure. He was speaking on a panel with Alex Gladstein. That's the chief strategy officer for the Human Rights Foundation. And they were talking about how Bitcoin can be used in the developing world in countries where their currencies are unstable. Essentially, governments are borrowing way too much money. They're printing out too much money. And thus, the value of the currency becomes useless. So he talked about in particular how he and the rapper Jay-Z have invested 500 Bitcoin into this new endowment to look in Africa and India to start Bitcoin development, and seeing how folks that don't trust their currency or are unable to use it, how they could potentially use Bitcoin as a solution.
And, you know, mentioning that controversial moment, he was actually cut off by conservative firebrand Laura Loomer. You know, for some of the people who've been taken off of Twitter, you talk about some of the other stuff that was discussed too, and you just mentioned it too, is going international and how Bitcoin could play a role in different countries. And one of them is a conversation about what it could do in Latin America. The president of El Salvador announced that his country would start allowing the currency's legal tender. Here's a little bit of the noise from that event.
Using the best ingredients that makes us who we are, while using sensibility to find the best examples of ideas from history and around the world. I believe Bitcoin could be one of these ideas. That is why next week, I will send to Congress a bill that will make Bitcoin a legal tender in El Salvador.
All right, so that's the president announcing it's going to be, he wants to make it a legal tender in El Salvador, but I mean, how could Bitcoin play a role in countries, especially that have unstable currency? How would that work?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. El Salvador is one of these examples that I just mentioned of a country whose currency has really been unstable for decades now. Back in 2001, they actually switched the national currency to the US dollar. But as you know, the Federal Reserve here has been printing a lot of money. The concerns about inflation aren't big for the US right now. But for countries like El Salvador, that inflation threat is really real. So now they have this concern where folks have US dollars and they can't spend them as much as they'd like to within the country. So Bitcoin could be a potential solution.
All right. You know what? I think we still have our Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett, on. Who's reported on this, and I wanted to ask him about this. Tim, are you there?
I am.
All right, Tim, I'm trying to understand this. What are the concerns long-term when you're trying to implement cryptocurrency as an actual currency in a country like El Salvador?
Oh, yes. I would be very, very wary of what El Salvador is doing, only because the previous examples we've had, like Venezuela, for example, a few years ago, it tried to launch a cryptocurrency called the Petro to try to raise money. As you know, Venezuela is suffering one of the worst economic collapses in the world today. So it's trying to raise funds through cryptocurrency. It really hasn't worked out very much at all for them. And one of the problems also with these companies, there's one that my colleague David Adams at Univision wrote about last week, very interesting article. And he wrote about a company called Trust Investing, run by a trio of Brazilians. And it is claiming that it can give 200% annual gains through its cryptocurrency operations. And a lot of people are buying into that, but it's also being accused of running essentially a Ponzi or pyramid scheme. Cubans, for example, their cryptocurrency is very popular with Cubans and Venezuelans. Why? Because the currencies in those countries are worthless. And so people in a sort of a desperate fashion are looking to cryptocurrency as a way to improve their financial futures.
Wow. 200% return. Okay. All right.
quite a claim. Quite
exactly. Tim, thank you so much. I appreciate that. You know, Chris, I know I tease, but you know, a lot of times you have this like image in your mind of who a cryptocurrency enthusiast is. Who was in the crowd? Who were the people there?
Yeah, you know, Lewis, I came into the conference myself sort of having this idea in mind of the quote unquote Bitcoin bros that would all be there. But it was actually a really eclectic mix. It was everybody from millennials dressed up like they were going to a music festival to executives in suits, to parents with their children that were genuinely interested in the future. One moment that stuck out to me on Saturday, I sat in on a recorded phone call from jail with Ross Ulbricht. You might remember him as the creator of the Silk Road. This was an online marketplace that allowed people to buy pretty much anything. Ulbricht was arrested and is now serving a life sentence. It was an emotional call. And I remember watching this young boy with his father sitting there listening together. It was not the image that I had in mind for a cryptocurrency conference, a much different perspective and experience.
And there was another person. This one, a really interesting story. You talked to Amira Perdomo. She's a personal assistant turned documentary filmmaker. And she talked to you a little bit about what got her interested in what she's doing.
Oddly enough, I had a friend who said, buy one Bitcoin. It was at 350. He's like, just buy one and hold it. And I said, okay. So I did. And then I bought another one. And then I bought another one. And then I waited. And when I looked, it was a lot more than what I invested.
All right, Chris.
Yeah, what's really cool about Myra's story, Lewis, is she started out as a personal assistant for millionaires and billionaires. And through the Bitcoin purchase that she made, she was able to save up enough money to become a documentary filmmaker. And now she's making her own documentary film about indigenous tribes across the globe. And we'll be talking to them about the potential for digital currencies.
And look, I have to say, I know that sometimes I laugh at it, but I also understand there are people who've done very well with it. So I just don't know how it works. Chris, tell me, there are a lot of optimists that you probably met at the conference about the future, but what's the reality of Bitcoin becoming a staple currency for us?
Yeah, so there's sort of a long road ahead. Essentially, this conference was billed for the folks that are very optimistic and bullish about the future of Bitcoin. But there's a lot of considerations. For one, Bitcoin mining is incredibly causes a lot of environmental degradation. The process of doing lots of complex algorithms on computers and servers is producing a lot of energy and takes a lot of electricity. Of course, as Tim mentioned, there's also the concern of Ponzi schemes that can come out of cryptocurrencies. With Bitcoin in particular, we've seen a lot of the volatility of it over time. And quite frankly, only 14% of investors have bought cryptocurrencies thus far. So it's still not as widespread in the marketplace as it would need to become a standard that could replace the US dollar someday.
Sounded like a really interesting and fascinating conference, though, for sure. It sounded like you had a lot of fun.
I did. And the last thing I'll add, Lewis, because I know you like video games, I met one guy there who told me he's created a video game where you can get paid in Bitcoin just to play video games.
All right. Well,
so there are all different opportunities sprouting out of this.
Depends on the game, I guess. We'll see. All right. Sundial Senior Producer Chris Remington. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right. That's our program for this Monday, June 7th. I don't know. Maybe it's the future. But, you know, if it works for you, go for it. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Puerto Rico's population demographics are changing. The new census data finds that millions of Puerto Ricans left the territory. They've come to the mainland. We're going to learn about the impact that's having on their economy. Plus, are you one of the many that have returned to the office? Do you have a furry friend that's stuck at home? Dogs do deal with anxiety just like we do. We're going to learn how you can help your dog overcome that separation because you're now back at the office. That's all coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. And remember, the program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.